Tonight in our study, we're beginning in the 20th chapter of Isaiah. And this is a short chapter, but it's a real interesting chapter. And it may sound a little conceited of me to say so, but I think that we just have to classify our Tuesday night Bible studies as being more of an advanced study, because we're dealing with some deep scriptures and some that are not easily understood, and the meaning many times is rather obscure, but yet we feel that it is most profitable for us to study them. Now, some of the background relating to this 20th chapter of Isaiah. This is a story of a city in Philistia that is captured by the Assyrians. And we've got a map up here that's small, and it doesn't really show very much in detail, but I'd like to point out this city on here. Maybe Esther can help us to point it out. The city is Ashdod. And you might even see better on the back of your Bibles if you have a little map there. Ashdod is a city on the seacoast that's almost directly west of Jerusalem. And it was a prime city because it was a city of maritime importance due to the fact that it was situated on the seacoast. And so in the first verse he says, "In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, when Sargon the king of Assyria sent him, and fought against Ashdod and took it." Now there's a whole mouthful in that one little verse. Judah, which is the kingdom of the south, you know, the God's people are divided into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom, which was Israel, and the southern kingdom, which was Judah. And Judah is most of the green portion there on that map. But between Judah and the seacoast was the country of Philistia. Well, Judah was threatened by Assyria, which was the nation up way up to the north. Assyria was taking territory all around, and it looked like Judah was certainly in the path of this oncoming army. And so they had a very great tendency to look to Egypt, down to the south, way to the south, which is not on that map. They looked to Egypt for help. And the problem is that they were not supposed to look to Egypt for help. They were supposed to look to God for help. And so this little chapter is designed to show Judah the futility of depending upon another source other than God for help. Well, one of the chief cities that Egypt occupied at this time, and which was important in the commerce, was this city of Ashdod. So he's going to show now what happened to Ashdod and the significance of that to Judah as they looked to Egypt for protection against Assyria. Now, these are some historical events, but as we study, we can apply each of these as they relate here. See, we're not going to need the map for a little while yet now. So he says, "In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod." Well, we know where Ashdod, that's the city. Well, now who was Tartan? Tartan was the captain of the army. I guess today we'd say the general of the army for Assyria. Well, in the year that he came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him and fought against Ashdod and took it. Now we have an important note here, and that is Sargon. Who was Sargon? Isaiah says that Sargon was the king of Assyria. But as we read here in Haley's Bible Handbook, he gives an important note about this verse. He says, "This is the only known mention of Sargon's name in extant ancient literature, thus mentioning the name of a king never known to have existed, the critic says, was one of the Bible's blunders." In other words, this little verse here in Isaiah is the only reference that could ever be found in history or literature of this king Sargon. So the big Bible, or rather historical scholars, said, well, the Bible's made a big blunder. They've named a king that doesn't even exist. We can't even find him in history. But as we read further, but amazing to be told, in 1842, a person named Botta discovered the ruins of Sargon's palace in Khorsbad on the north edge of Nineveh, with treasures and inscriptions showing him to have been one of Assyria's greatest kings. Yet his name had disappeared from history, save this lone mention in Isaiah to Botta's discovery. In recent years, the ruins of Sargon's palace have been excavated by the Oriental Institute, and on the next page are reproductions of photographs of the ruins of Sargon's throne room, his throne, and the great stone bull which guarded his doorway. From inscriptions, it is learned that Shalmaneser died while besieging Samaria, and that he was succeeded by Sargon, who completed the capture. Furthermore, verifying the statement above quoted from Isaiah 20, verse 1, an inscription of Sargon says, Azariah, king of Ashdod, planned in his heart not to pay tribute. In my anger, I marched against Ashdod with my usual bodyguard. I conquered Ashdod and Gath. I took their treasures and their people. I settled in them people from the lands of the east. I took tribute from Philistia, Judah, Edom, and Moab. So to me, that's very interesting to note that the Bible is right, after all, and it stands the proof of all of the tests of history and archaeology and so on. The Bible was right for centuries when man had no other source to know about this king except this one verse in Isaiah. So Sargon was the king of Assyria. He followed Shalmaneser, and he was before Sennacherib. And you know, Sennacherib is the one who then really got down to the very door of Jerusalem before he was stopped by God. So what is this prophecy about? It's in the year that Tartan, who was the captain of the army, came to Ashdod, which is that principal city we showed on the map, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him and fought against Ashdod and took it. At the same time spake the Lord by Isaiah, the son of Amoz. Now, of course, Isaiah is our prophet that we're reading from. And the Lord spoke to Isaiah and by Isaiah, saying, now let's look for just a moment now at the office of Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet. And what does a prophet do? A prophet takes the things of God and gives them to man. What does a priest do? A priest takes the things of man and gives them to God. So Isaiah was a prophet, and so God spoke to the people through his prophet Isaiah. So at the same time, that is whenever this year came in which they launched onto the attack of this city, the Lord spoke to Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying, go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. Now the clothing of the prophets was probably a unique clothing, and it was austere. They wore this sackcloth, which was probably made out of some kind of hair, maybe camel's hair, and it was rough clothing. They had a leather gird about them. In 2 Kings 1:18, we read of Elisha's dress, and he dressed the same way. John the Baptist dressed very similarly. Well, all this is simply saying here is that Isaiah was told to loose the sackcloth from off thy loins and put off thy shoe from thy foot. And he did so walking naked and barefoot. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that he was absolutely naked. It just simply means that he didn't have on the clothing that went with his office of a prophet. He took off the sackcloth and the shoes so that nobody could recognize him from his clothing as being the prophet Isaiah. And it doesn't hurt the language here at all to interpret it that way. But he did this as a symbol. Verse 3, and the Lord said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners. Now this was a sign, Isaiah having to take off the sackcloth and the shoes. It was a sign of what God was going to do to Egypt and Ethiopia. That is, they were going to be captured, they were going to be overrun by an invading power, and they would no longer be of any use to assist Judah in their protection and defense against Assyria. Now he said, verse 3, now, and the Lord said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot. Then he says, 3 years for a sign and wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia. There's a lot of disagreement as to how this sentence should be punctuated. And it doesn't necessarily mean that Isaiah walked this way for 3 years, but it means that he might have done this intermittently for 3 years, or that he might have done this and it was going to be a sign that would be upon Egypt and Ethiopia for 3 years. So shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. So this was going to happen to Egypt and Ethiopia. Now Ethiopia is, you know, even further south of Egypt. Neither of these two countries are on our map. Our map is too limited over there. And he's just simply showing these people of Judea that the great strength that they looked to and they leaned upon for assistance wasn't going to be around to help them. Now another interesting thing here is, he says they're going to be naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. They found on the Egyptian inscriptions pictures showing captives that had been taken either by them or by other nations, and invariably these captives are in an unclothed or poorly clothed state. So to capture somebody and to lead them away captive and take off their clothes or just let them be scantily clothed was a sign of complete subjection. It was a sign of actually shame. And so he says, to the shame of Egypt. Now this word for shame here, and I just mentioned this in passing, this word for shame here is erva. And the word erva is the very same word found in Deuteronomy 24, in which he gives the law of divorce in the Old Testament. And in giving the law of divorce, he said when a man had taken a wife and married her, if it come to pass that he finds some uncleanness in her, and give her a bill of divorce and send her out of his house, that word for some uncleanness is this same word erva. And it's found some 50 times in the Old Testament. And every time it is translated nakedness, except this one time right here in which it's translated shame. But then you can see, then looking at the context, that it really means nakedness in this passage too. So consistently that word means something to do with nakedness. And it was the only reason that they could put them away in the Old Testament. And we know that was, of course, for fornication. Well, in verse 5, and they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory. Now, Ethiopia was their expectation. That is, it was the expectation of Judah. They were looking to Ethiopia for help, and Egypt was the glory of Judah. They were looking to Egypt for help. And the mistake here is that they should have been looking to God for help, and not looking to those other powers round about them to assist them in their troubles with the heathen nations. And of course, this is a very important lesson for us today, as we sometimes get our values all mixed up. And we begin to place glory, and we begin to place expectation, we begin to place hope in the wrong things. And just as surely as we have hope in something in this life, if we'll just be very objective about it, we're going to see that that thing, that object, whatever it is, whether it's a group of people or whether it's an inanimate thing, it's not going to be around here very long. It's not going to be available to help us in the time that we really need it. And so it's a false source of hope. And, you know, we've seen things that have been powerful. Maybe it's a political power. Maybe it's some other kind of a power. And we think, well, now that thing is just going to always be. It's going to always stand. There's no way that it can ever be shaken. But maybe just give it a few years and it no longer even exists as a power. It's not able to help anybody, and it's sure not able to hurt anybody because it's no longer even there. But whenever Egypt and Ethiopia were led away naked, with their buttocks showing, and in a state of shame, they certainly couldn't be of any assistance to Judea. And so Judea should have been looking to God all along instead of to the wrong source for help. So, and they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia and Egypt. And so it is with us. Whenever we have other gods, so to speak, than the true God in heaven that we look to for assistance, we're going to be afraid of them, we're going to be ashamed of them whenever we really do need the help and they're not available or not able to give us any assistance. Verse 6, and the inhabitant of this isle shall say in that day. Now this isle has to be a term referring to Palestine. You can see it's right on the seacoast. And it's just a body of land on the edge of the water, and it's called this isle in other places also. The inhabitant of this isle shall say in that day, behold, such is our expectation. That is, they're just captives now. That's what, there goes our hope. Whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and how shall we escape? That's going to be the big question. Where are we going to go for help when we try to escape this king of Assyria? How are we going to escape from it? There goes our expectation. There goes our glory and our hope. Not going to be of any benefit to us. And of course, the logical answer to this question here is that you must turn to the Lord. You must turn to the true God for your help, for your assistance in time of need. For He it is, and only He, who will be able to give you the help. Now, let's begin chapter 21. And we find in this chapter there are three different prophecies